Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Rachel Smith, COO of ExchangeWire. Sort of feel like it's a bit redundant to introduce myself these days.
Never.
But want to mix it up.
Yeah.
Want to mix it up.
What if you're a brand new listener that's ever heard of you before?
Yes, good point, Lindsay. Yep. Lindsay Rowntree, Head of Content from ExchangeWire.
Yes, thank you.
Hello.
Hi there.
And special guest in the studio this morning, Julian Savage-Lee from DigiCake. Hello, Julian.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. Welcome to a slightly warm and muggy ExchangeWire Towers. The studio lacks air conditioning and ventilation, but anyway.
We too managed. Noisy.
Yeah. So let's get cracking with conversations on the news stories of the week. First news story that I wanted to touch on is News Corp's announcement that they're going to be launching their own news aggregation platform tool called News, spelt
News.
Yes, KNEWSZ. I want to say S.
Yeah.
Z.
Because you're an adult, not a 12-year-old.
Exactly. So we've had lots of amusing chats about the title and why they selected the title. I'm sure you guys will have a view. But principally, this is being driven internally from News Corp, they say, because they feel that other news aggregation platforms and social media platforms are surfacing news stories in a way that's not necessarily transparent and is relatively biased. So they want to build a platform that aggregates news stories in a slightly different way. It's not going to necessarily preference news stories that are not behind a paywall. So those news outlets that have a subscription service paywall in place are not going to be disadvantaged by this. They're also going to be collecting news, obviously, across their own properties, but a wide range of much smaller, more independent news platforms as well. There isn't a lot of detail on any of the articles that I read about how they're actually going to sort of deal with user data in this instance and how they might maybe personalize some of the content towards users, because, you know, it begs the question that if someone's got concerns about how people are discovering news on social media platforms, well, how is a news aggregation tool that is personalized any different from that? I'm sure there's lots of technical reasons as to how that is different. So that will be interesting. And they're also sort of pushing this and promoting this under the banner of wanting to recognize and reward, but also protect the provenance of journalism. So it's a real play at trying to compete with Google News, Apple News, Facebook as a news discovery tool. And it seems like it's a very interesting proposition and quite timely. So what is your perspective on this? Julian, I know you've got a lot of experience on the sort of publisher side of the business. I'm really interested to think what you made of this story, to hear what you made of this story.
Yeah, it's great to see that there is another alternative that's coming from a different source than a technology company, first and foremost.
Just a shame it's News Corp though, right?
Well, we discussed this before going on air, right? And I've already expressed some concerns about the fact that, you know, there's people who will not pick up news properties. You know, there are boycotts in place in UK universities, as an example. And not to take a strong moral stance from my personal perspective, if I have one about this, there's actually a slightly different issue, which is that by aggregating as a type of vendor that they are, how is this going to not end up in a bun fight of another publisher cooperative? Mm. I love publisher cooperatives. In theory, they are a great idea. It would be so fantastic to have seen a model that could work. But even talking with somebody just yesterday who has spent a lot of time in print and at newspapers, they will tell you that it's an ego-driven place, and it's really difficult to get that mindset from print out to technology and to smooth that over. And you know, Facebook and Google, more than eating your lunch, come and having your breakfast and your dinner as well at the same time, is not enough for them to work together. So how is this going to work out? How long is this going to last is the question I'd ask.
That's what's really interesting. I was thinking many of exactly the same things. How will other news properties be okay with allowing their stories on a aggregation platform that's been run by one of their key competitors? On the other hand, could this actually be a prelude to pooling together a number of global publisher resources and setting up some kind of single sign-on approach, because they're going to have such a vast array of user data? But, you know, they're sort of they're sort of two, they're sort of opposite ends of the one issue, and I just wonder whether they'll have any success in tackling either. What do you think, Lindsay?
I feel like it would, if that were to be the case, it would be more targeted towards the much smaller, more niche news sites, a bit like how a lot of the kind of the streaming sites, TV streaming sites exist at the moment, like Pluto TV, that work with, you know, the fishing channels and those kind of things that you would never normally watch unless you're an enthusiast. These kind of smaller news sites that you wouldn't read, again, unless you're an enthusiast, are the ones that might welcome the support from some a big behemoth like News Corp to kind of help them grow and help them kind of gain a new user base. And actually, it could just be News Corp's way of creating a, you know, an even bigger bigger scale than they currently have. They're not likely to be able to work with direct peers of them. I can't see how that could work, because again, Julian, like you were saying, in that kind of co-op there'd be too many egos at play. I mean, obviously News UK, News is part of Ozone, like that's the publisher co-op that we're seeing working along the data approach. But in New Zealand, CAPEX has just shut down, another example of where publisher co-op hasn't worked. So I don't see how the egos at play here would make that any different, but I do see how it could work for the smaller ones that, you know, need an audience that news could actually help them deliver and grow their own audience in the process.
Another single sign-on would be great, right? As a consumer, it would be good to have a single sign-on, because, you know, I keep on being offered Facebook as a consumer and I just think, oh, I don't really want to tell you that I'm signing into this travel site. I don't want to tell you that I'm signing into this video, you know, platform. I just don't want you to know. So it'd be good to have another example. And publishers are desperate for another revenue source. Like, consistently, I speak to publishers, and one of the key things that when I get asked to speak to publishers as a consultant is, can you help me make more money? Like, can you help the SSPs work better for me, or is there a different revenue source? So there's some who are going to feel failed by Apple because there's not been enough revenue through that. There's going to be some that fail to be approved by Apple News. So that's another opportunity there. The reality is that we get into a problem where most people get their stories for a news feed, right? It was like 68%, I think, in the US, according to that Netflix documentary. In some countries, like Myanmar, it's total, you know, because Facebook is the internet. So sadly, we remain in a real bind as a society, right? And not just as an industry, about that exchange of monetary value for quality products and services. And the Gen Z, right, they've grown up with the internet, so they weren't around to understand that value exchange of ads for free content. So they don't value journalism. So if you're 20 years old now, news is free. News has always been free. So it's been devalued. And if News Corp think that putting together a kid-friendly news,
like you said,
is that what you think this is? Like,
I fear it is.
News.
I fear, because I'm trying to walk a very tight line here of like trying to be positive about something that I've said that I love two of these things, right? Publisher co-ops, I think, are great. Single sign-on, the sharing of data between major publishers and an alternative to Google, Facebook would be fantastic. But at the same time, I can't help but look at things that have happened around us and things that have failed, and understand what a 20-year-old would tell me if I asked them about it, and just go, oh, God, this is never going to work.
It does feel like, I suppose, in that regard, a little bit of a confused proposition. Like, but maybe that's because we don't clearly understand exactly what they're going after, right? So what is their, what's the monetization model going to look like around this, and how are they going to be transferring revenue onto those other publisher sites that are contributing stories to their aggregation platform, and how is that going to perhaps offer something a little more alluring to those publishers than they could get via the other existing platforms? Or, as you say, Lindsay, is it simply that they'll be going after particular niche publications or pieces of content? So are news coming at this from the perspective truly of trying to compete with Google and Facebook, i.e. let's build a news aggregation tool that's more popular, or that's more wide-reaching, or that's at least as popular or getting near to? Or are they just simply sort of flexing their muscles and going, had enough of this? You tech platforms should not be dictating what people are reading in the news. Actually, we're going to start to take that on. Because arguably, who else is big enough? Who else has got deep enough pockets to probably build something like this from a tech perspective that isn't a tech company? Maybe it had to always be in the hands of a company the size of News Corp.
Yeah, it's a good point. I'm just thinking back to how you would engage with a consumer, right? So if you're News Corp, you could probably try and find a way to muscle in. But as a consumer, a lot of people wake up in the morning and they'll open up. Maybe they'll open up Apple News. Maybe they'll open up Facebook. Maybe they'll ask a voice activated device to tell them what the news is. Where's the in? Like, how are you going to disrupt that and become on a par with those? I remember, and I can't remember the name of it, unfortunately, but there was this 16-year-old kid who built this app that aggregated all the news, and Yahoo bought it about 10 years ago. Now, that was a really interesting, innovative thing of its time. If News Corp had something like that and it was a slightly different proposition on a news digest, that would be fantastic. Unfortunately, some of their titles are so wide-ranging in terms of content, from the Times to the Sun in the UK, of like whether one's tabloid style and one's, you know, more literate, shall we say. It's going to be very difficult to break through and to try and be able to target, you know, what do you want to listen to first thing? How do you want to get your news? Do you want to get a publication given to you like The Sun, which is going to be super simple to understand? Or do you want to get something that's a bit more
thought-led?
Thought-led, highbrow, thought-provoking. I don't know.
Yeah, because they've got a good platform to promote it, which to promote it on through of their current publications. They can promote it. But if I'm a Sun reader, I don't really care about you launching a news aggregation app across what I would deem to be all of your publications, because like you said, Julian, I couldn't give a crap about the Times if I read the Sun, and probably vice versa. But then there's the other kind of side of things is like Update, Axel Springer.
Yes, I was about to mention them.
They are native on certain handsets, and the same with, you know, Taboola News when they launch. Obviously, it's another tech company, but they launch kind of very much to work with the publisher, for the publisher. Again, they've got deals with, I think, some of the Chinese handsets. I think ZTE, another one, where they are automatically installed on the handset before you even set it up. So that seems to me like it could be one of the best ways of actually getting almost a ready-made audience. But outside of that, how can you promote and win with another news aggregation app?
I'll definitely be excited to see how this develops.
Yeah.
Because there's things I want to support.
They're still exploring, apparently. So if it even does come of anything.
Well, this is it. They're talking about launching it in a couple of months' time. So presumably the reason for talking about it now is maybe to either whet people's appetites and or to start getting conversations going where they're thinking, okay, there are a few things we need to pay attention to here. But, I mean, because, you know, as you mentioned, Update, Lindsay, when we were talking about them a little while ago, the thing that I found interesting about Update is that actually it's almost like a brand within Axel Springer, a standalone brand within Axel Springer, where I think something like 70% of the company at Update at the moment are journalists.
Yeah.
So it's almost like a news content creation house all on its own. And then they've got you know, various other staff, including their sort of monetization team, their ads and monetization team. So it is a very clear sort of additional monetization vehicle, I suppose, owned by Axel Springer and an Axel Springer owned company, but a standalone sort of news outfit. I wonder if for News Corp, the degree to which they can really push this and make this successful might depend on defining that. You know, is news so annoying? I mean, you know, is
Canews?
Thank you. Is Canews going to be viewed as a sort of standalone, separate brand, or will people always just think, oh yeah, that's just, you know, News Corp's properties, you know, delivered to me via an app or via some other kind of platform that I view on my mobile, you know? And also, I think if anyone said to me, there's a News Corp app that aggregates news, I would automatically assume that I'm going to be reading News Corp property stories and maybe any other smaller independent, I say in air quotes, publishers or content providers that are absolutely 100% aligned with those existing News Corp properties. So I wouldn't see it as independent. I wouldn't see it necessarily as agnostic.
But I guess your layman wouldn't know necessarily that Canews is from News Corp, right? A bit like your layman wouldn't know that Update is actually owned
from
and run
Axel Springer,
by Axel Springer. Like, I guess it's a similar sort of thing. It's designed to be an independent entity. So, yeah, interesting to see.
Well, this is the thing. I think there's so much that's still a little undefined around this, but, you know, agree with you 100%, Julie. You know, we're big fans of the idea of publishers taking back some control over their content, over their user data, and putting that to good use to build, fair, sophisticated revenue models that are going to ensure their longevity as businesses, as companies. We're also big fans of the notion and the principles behind publisher co-ops, and really watch with interest to see how that all develops. And, I mean, yeah, a single sign-on would be great.
Yeah, it would be good to have an alternative, right? You say, could they just not make friends? But if you're talking about this Axel Springer project, which I will admit I didn't know about, why are they not collaborating?
Yeah, who?
True, yeah.
Upday and News. But see, I think those are conversations yet to be had. That's what I think is really interesting about this. I think we are at a moment in time where publishers, opportunities are becoming much more diversified, right? So, you know, there's all sorts of co-op potentials. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of aggregation tools and platform potentials. I would be really interested to know what kind of conversations are going on behind the scenes on all of this.
I wish them luck.
Yeah.
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 You know, if they want to talk to you guys, they should definitely get in touch. If they want to talk to me, I'd definitely contribute whatever I can to try and help, because we do need an alternative as a society. Because like I say, if you're 20 years old now, news is free and they're running businesses that are paying journalists, and journalists are not going to be able to be paid any longer at some point soon, because when those 20-year-olds become 30, they're still not going to understand the value proposition of the fact that their friends are journalists and their friends earning, you know, not enough to pay the rent. It's
indeed
beyond ridiculous.
Yep. All right. That was Knews. Okay. So second news story that I wanted to chat about was Google publishing on their blog late last week a statement about their position on cookie tracking. So obviously we've been talking about this, you know, in one form or another fairly consistently since Google made an announcement back in May about ITP2. And it was keenly anticipated that they would do something to restrict the use of third-party cookie targeting and tracking altogether at some point. Now, they've actually come out in a blog announcement last week saying that they don't intend to do that. So they are going to – they have no intention to eliminate cookies altogether, not at this stage anyway, because they feel that eliminating cookies altogether will open up other privacy issues that are going to potentially harm or impact users. They go into a bit of detail about what those privacy issues might be. And they also talk about their recognition of the fact that cookie targeting is legitimately used for many businesses, principally publishing businesses on the internet, to drive revenue through ad-funded models. They also talk about how important they feel personalized advertising is as opposed to anonymized advertising. They refer to a survey that they'd run to try to understand how users respond to unpersonalized advertising, and the results of that survey were pretty astoundingly sort of easy to interpret, that actually the less personalized advertising is, the more that irritates the user, the less they engage, and then the less revenue that then goes onwards to the publisher. So they've made some pretty bold statements, and they've also talked in this blog about how they're setting up a privacy sandbox approach, and they're encouraging people to learn a little bit more about that and to have a conversation with them. They're kind of launching this as a consultation period. And the privacy sandbox goes into a bit more detail about what they want to do and how they think they could manage the privacy issue whilst still keeping the cookie alive for the purpose of some sense of vibrancy across the internet, and also as a tool to enable publishers to continue to monetize their content. Very connected to, in many ways, to what we were just talking about. Julian, what's your perspective on this announcement?
Yeah, so first things first, it's important to understand where this has come from, right? So this is the engineering director, Justin Shull, of Chrome's Security and Privacy. I hope I pronounced his name correctly. it's very interesting to look at the fact that the Chrome team are putting this out shortly before a survey which they reference the financial impact. So there's a line in there about publishers losing a certain amount of revenue. And actually, now we're looking at this a few days later, that full document has come out. So I was looking into that document and it's pretty scary stuff, right? I mean, publishers, the average publisher revenue decrease is 52% from a 96-day interval period, which was May to August.
And this is in the context of unpersonalized advertising.
Unpersonalized ads, yeah, and about blocking cookies, yeah. Because cookies are fundamentally how real-time bidding works. Mm. You know, there has to be a drop on the supply-side platform side, which then informs demand-side platforms. Demand-side platforms then use that information to work out whether or not they know the user and whether firstly they want to bid, and then if they are going to bid, how well do they know that user, what kind of targeting is there, what campaigns are set up for them, how much are they going to bid, in other words. So some lost 75%. These are big numbers.
Something, it's quite, these are big overwhelming numbers.
Yeah. And it leads me to think that, you know, getting ahead of this, Chrome having a position is probably because the teams are talking to each other within Google. You'd like to think there's some joined up thinking, at least, right? And and that they're recognizing that if they were to take a stance like Apple have done, then they are going to fundamentally break some things. Now, it could be things that they break within their own business and cause revenue downfall from another sector of their business, if you're looking at it from a negative poking holes kind of methodology from the outside. Or it could just be that they just wanted to run the survey and they wanted to see what would happen before they made any decisions. Mm. And the decision is, if we go and act like Apple does, we start to see articles, which again, 2 days ago, this came out from Tim Ellison of Digital Balance, an article which was quoted, "Is Apple ITP breaking the internet?" And the comments of this article, just the top line summary, is that within 24 hours, 20 or 30% of all visitors on Safari become ghosts. You can't target them. They stay in your pools. And 50% of those are on mobile, 10% on desktop. So Apple have made the action, is my point here. Google have recognized they could make the action, but the Chrome team instead have worked with the scientists on the display ads team. And they've done some surveys, they've done some research, and they've shared that information, and they've taken an approach of, hey, let's talk about this.
Which is quite interesting and in stark contrast to Apple's approach. But Lindsay, is this Google being self-interested, or are they really the sort of protectors of the vibrant and open internet?
Well, they're always going to be self-interested. Mm. It ultimately will come down to their bottom line and their flow of money. And it's interesting that they, like Julian, doing your investigating, discovering that actually it shows that the teams, the ads team and the browser team are connecting on this in some way and looking at kind of what negative impact this could have down the line. And I guess also looking at what's happened in other parts of the industry. We talk about Safari, obviously Brave as well, and how whether they're trying to protect the user or try to protect their own revenue streams, whatever the outcome of that is ultimately not really working, or they're having troubles with it. Like ITP, we talked about it last week. ITP has been a struggle and a pain in the backside for Apple. They've had to keep launching new versions of it to try and keep whittling down, you know, understanding what the issue is and how people are still able to target despite them launching ITP. Google will be looking at this and thinking, actually, you know, Safari don't give a crap about revenue from their browser. All their revenue will comes from things like Apple News. It comes from their the device ID. It comes from Apple News. It comes from the App Store. If it's a way of them trying to get advertisers to divert their money from spending targeting users in the Safari browser to investing in mobile in-app mobile advertising instead, then it's an interesting approach. They've got a lot of work to do. Whereas Google needs that web money. They need that money. They need to understand that that's where their money is coming from, the advertisers. And if it's affecting the publishers, and the publishers are seeing less revenue, and that could be because the advertisers aren't spending with the publishers because they aren't able to target effectively, they're going to put the money elsewhere instead, then Google needs to see that as an issue, and Chrome will see that as an issue. And Julian, you asked a good question earlier. What does it come down to? What is more important to Google? Mm. Is it Chrome or is it ads?
I mean, the way that it's looking in certain jurisdictions, the governments are likely to do something about at least one tech company soon. So if it does come to a push and a shove kind of situation, then, you know, if you had to make a decision between the ad stack that's not search,
yes,
search, ads and YouTube or Chrome, then I think, you know, if they were told you could only keep two or three, they would probably say, look, let's keep Chrome, let's definitely keep search, and we'll probably choose YouTube as well, right?
So the ads, rest are dispendable.
Ads get the push. And the thing is, if they leave a broken ad system on departing it, that would be terrible
in their wake.
Would be terrible in the wake, because a lot of people will probably look to sort of cut back on search as a penalizing measure for, you know, you've ruined parts of what I'm trying to do, so therefore I'm not going to spend on search with you. The reality is that I think that they've probably tried to take that approach of where, like with OpenRTB, they can lead because they're so important and so dominant. Here, I think they've released some documentation and they've decided they'll do some research, and they've realized that actually it's really not so straightforward. In fact, the author of that piece from the Chrome security and privacy team did actually mention that it will take years to realign this.
And that's
an overnight solution.
No.
Well, exactly.
And then that's another thing as well, is that from a sort of purely technical point of view, it is interesting that they are turning their attention to looking at some other ways that you could track users around the internet that is more anonymized but still meaningful. And so they went into a bit of detail on the Chromium blog, because this appeared on the other blog, Keyword blog, right? So then you get, if you want to learn a little bit more in detail, you can read something else on the Chromium blog where they talked a bit about how they wanted to do that. They talked about creating federated pools of users, so creating ways in which to identify people, but only once there's a certain minimum number of people sort of doing the same action, so that they're not just identifying one individual, such as you, Julian, going to X website. They're only identifying you as a potential individual once many others have done the same thing.
The counter thing to that is that everybody who works in an agency or has some semblance about how advertising is bought and works, say, on the publisher side, they will just say, look, we think that in doing this, you're going to prioritize your own systems. Because whilst you've got this position, you're going to, like, you say you limit pools to certain other buyers, but there's no way of investigating within the Google stack whether or not you're actually treating yourself as fairly as you treat everybody else. That, I mean, people are going to throw stones, right? It's as simple as that.
They will, but I think at the same time, they will know that it's still going to be the easiest option for them to buy through. So
despite
the fact that they will be questioning it and going, what are you actually playing at here? Are you trying to prioritize yourself over others? It's still easiest for us to put our money into you. And that's the argument around Apple at the moment as well. Like, advertisers can't put their money into Apple. They would divert it into in-app advertising, but it's too complicated and they don't trust it yet because there's still a lot of questions around fraud in that space. So ultimately, we'll end up just putting our money back into Google again because that's the easier option, regardless of what questions we have around what your tactics are.
Yeah.
And I mean, again, I wonder if it's a scenario of a number of different things going on at the same time, right? Because where I was going with that is that wouldn't it be better for Apple to be pouring their energies into working on these technical issues and some potential solves for these technical issues now before some kind of anti-competition regulation comes down the line and says, hang on a minute, you can't do everything here and we don't really know if you're prioritizing your own business over others. It's great that you're doing all of this work, but actually, are you personally benefiting from it over and above other people? So let's start talking about breaking you up. Well, in the meantime, let them get on with doing as much technical work as they possibly can to try to solve some of these issues. Open up the conversation and the dialogue to a wider community, which, let's face it, Apple doesn't do at all. I mean, we've had this conversation on our podcast a couple of times this year. To what extent do Apple consult with the wider, you know, web community about some of the decisions they take? Zero, pretty much. So let's say Google are adopting a different approach, then wouldn't that at least take us towards a place where we could start talking about this concept of what does an anonymous internet look like versus a kind of trusted internet, right? Which is, you know, if you strip out all cookie usage, then everything becomes anonymous. And whilst that might satisfy some people's desire from a privacy perspective, it also means your experience is completely different, right? And so if you're like, you're almost wandering around the internet slightly blindfolded, bumping into all sorts of things and only finding things if you know how to get there. If we can move from that side of the coin over to this trusted internet where actually you understand the value proposition that you were mentioning earlier, Julian, when we were talking about canoes, the idea that actually I get something in exchange for my data, but we could probably only get to that trusted bit if we actually understand what's happening in between and if we trust the people or the organisations that are trying to develop some tools that either make it more transparent or make it easier or at least enable us to understand how this stuff gets to us, how this stuff appears on our web browser, how this stuff appears in a targeted fashion on our phones.
Now, whilst that isn't really something that the general public have access to right now, what I will say is that this study does back it up. So I didn't give the title of it earlier. It's actually called Effect of Disabling Third-Party Cookies on Publisher Revenue, right? And it was written by...
Catchy. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, yeah. It was written by the Display Ads and the Google Ad Manager team. Now, this does actually back you up because in the footnotes, there was something I picked up upon which said that users expressed a greater dissatisfaction with non-personalized ads. In fact, 21% increase on click-throughs, on clicks to close the ad. And when they were asked why they were closing the ad, 29% of that group said that they'd seen the ad multiple times, and 21% said that they were not interested in the ad. So therefore, what has happened here is consumers are getting used to personalized ads. And when they get non-personalized ads in a sample group as part of this study, they are actually speaking out and saying, actually, you know what? I don't know what this experience is, but I don't like it. And the thing that takes me back is when you compound that part of the statistics from the survey, you actually get to this really scary part, which was that news was the most affected revenue vertical, 62% of revenue. And obviously, we have already seen in France a huge amount of money going from Google to French news publishers because of the effect of Google on its business. And it would be silly to suggest that there is not some joined up thinking, because if you think about it logically from that reverse point of the footnote back to the topic of the discussion, you end up in a position where you just think, well, users, if we make users do something and they don't like it, they're going to tell us. And the impact is that we kill publisher by 62%. And there's already a legal precedent in the EU to pay that 62%. So Google could end up making a change and then having to fit the shortfall. App, on the other hand, seem like they are not really worried about it and not really caring about it.
No, I think that's fair enough. And one of the stats you just pointed out there was, you know, I don't want to see this ad because I've seen it already. And it's the how far can we take, how much to what level you can target a user versus can we just bring back, if you're going to do this and if you're going to try and switch off cookies or do whatever you want to do with a cookie, can you at least find a way for us to effectively frequency cap? Because if we can't frequency cap, then we're all screwed.
Yeah,
because
of course.
Advertisers will stop investing money in advertising if they can't frequency cap. Users will desensitize themselves to all ads even more so than they already are.
Do everything like
it's a lose-lose situation. So at least can we get the basics right and allow us to be able to measure correctly and to at least frequency cap, and then we work out how far we take the data targeting after that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Well, maybe this is the prelude to kind of tackling some of that on a much wider scale in a bit more of an open environment where people can converse about it. I don't know.
Mm.
Maybe, maybe not. Let's move on to the third news story of the week, which was now. I swear to God, I read this in the news this week that the Trade Desk, a little sort of summary of the Trade Desk's stock trajectory since it IPO'd. And I definitely knowingly saw some updates about this on LinkedIn and unfortunately couldn't find the news source, but it was very helpfully summarized in a couple of LinkedIn posts. So, and I thought it was really interesting and we should definitely talk about it, which is that since IPOing, the Trade Desk's stock price has increased something like 1,300% from the date of IPO, which is phenomenal, not just in ad tech, but for tech in general. So that's the sort of fastest growing trajectory in terms of stock price for any tech company on the stock exchange since the 2009 recession. And for comparison, I think Google stock price only rose something like Facebook stock price only rose something like 388% over that same period. So we're talking about phenomenal growth for the Trade Desk in a particular period. And I thought this was interesting because I think it says something about ad tech. I know we've talked about the Trade Desk's sort of fortuitous IPO position in the past on the podcast, and we've wondered to what extent they can continue to grow and at what pace. But I think there's something beyond this, which is that we're also seeing some growth in other ad tech companies in the last year. So something like, I think, 3 times growth on a position over a 12-month period for both Rubicon and also Telaria. So that makes me wonder whether we're starting to see some a bit of a heyday for independent ad tech, and also whether we're seeing something in terms of ad tech versus other tech companies in a public stocks marketplace. What did you think off the back of this particular story, Julian?
Well, first of all, I think we should, you know, be congratulating everybody who's at the trade desk for this continued growth and this, you know, for very, very fortuitous but hard-worked run. It's incredible. I mean, if you are in the public eye like Facebook are and your stock price is being talked about on a daily basis on news channels, you're very much going under the radar as an ad tech company. And that's very lucky when things are not going well. But when things are going well, people do need to stand up and be applauded. So, yeah, you know, congratulations to everybody there, particularly those who obviously got some stock and held on to it at this point in time. You know, well done.
Phenomenal effort. Lindsay?
I mean, I agree with everything Julian just said. I think it's fantastic. And obviously when the Trade Desk IPO'd, there were questions around if it was the right time, if they should be doing that, should they be looking at being acquired instead? Is the valuation too high, far too high, many thought, and you know, they would pop right out of the gate, but then it would start to crash right afterwards. They've just continued to show growth and growth and growth, and there've been some interesting moves from the Trade Desk. For example, a big one for them being the focus on Asia, on China,
yeah,
and how that's kind of helped them be seen, you know, trying to get out of the US and realize that while the US is an important market, there are so many growth opportunities outside of that, and being so bullish and bold in many areas like that, I think has probably helped them no end. But I guess the next question for them is, what is next? Like, they've come this far. The pressure is always on them. Once you IPO and you see that kind of growth, you now have to try and maintain that, at least steady it, if not grow it further.
Yeah.
What's your next trajectory look like? Kind of what are your focuses?
And we know from having Jeff Green on stage at ATS Singapore a couple of years ago, that, you know, he was really bullish about the opportunity in connected TV and internet-enabled TV. And you've got to believe that that's probably still front and centre of their growth strategies. So it sort of seems the two things that he was, you know, really interested in talking about at that time was connected TV and obviously growth in Asia. And perhaps those are two things that they've been busy working on in that intervening 18 months or so since that particular ATS Singapore. And they're probably seeing some movement there, but there's still enormous potential to grow within both of those particular areas. I mean, when we talked about connected TV at that ATS Singapore, he was saying, if you can just imagine how much the TV industry is being revolutionized at the moment, you know, and this is nothing in comparison to what we've done in terms of digital advertising. So the potential for growth and opportunity is far, far, far greater. We just don't quite see it yet because we're still at the very beginning of it, and we're still trying to tackle some of the most sort of basic elements and issues of digitizing that TV experience. So is that where we're going to see growth for the Trade Desk, or do you think they've got some other tricks under their hat?
I'm not too sure. I mean, first and foremost, part of the reason why they've been so successful is because of the strategy, as you've outlined, right? There are certain facets to that which really, like, chime in. If I think back 18 months or 2 years ago, you know, they're really competent in multiple ways, right? Like, some of the they've done what agencies want, and they've delivered that under the nose of other demand side platforms that somehow in some markets just didn't see them coming, right? Didn't see them growing, didn't see them being a competitor in some respects.
Well, they played to what the agencies wanted, which other DSPs haven't necessarily ever done.
No, of
they've
course.
They've used them despite, like, almost begrudgingly, whereas the traders have gone, you are our core market.
Yeah. And the reality is that, you know, from coming from the side where I've got the most experience in terms of supply side platforms and demand side platform management, they are one of the most competent. You know, their team will handle integrations and get things done quickly and on time. And so many other companies don't, you know, that's the reality in the ad tech ecosystem. And they're competent. They get on with it, and they're very good at what they do, and they do it, and they get it done. So connected TV was a really messy place like 2 years ago, 18 months ago. I used to get people who would come and say, right, we were interested in doing this brief for connected TV. What are the avails? And it was impossible to get realistic avails. Even when you got some numbers together, you could highlight that there was a couple of fraud vendors in there. Like, it was kind of obvious that there was people who were sort of jumping out of the arbitrage market from certain Middle Eastern countries and jumping into connected TV because it was, you know, the new Wild
next
West.
Opportunity.
The next opportunity to defraud, yeah. Mm. And I think that those guys, you know, really jumped upon that, because the funny thing with the OpenRTB spec was it went in directions to add certain things like audio, like digital out of home. But connected TV was not seen as being a specific thing it was adding. So therefore, the rest of the market was like, what? And the trade desk sat down, discussed it internally, and clearly worked out how they were going to piece together bits of information to make a strategy to go to market, to collect money, spend it, and deliver on these campaigns, which is where everybody else failed. And it comes back to being competent.
Yeah. It sounds so simple, doesn't it?
Like, I mean, in retrospect, it definitely does.
Do it well, but you know, we can see the success story. What about any thoughts on Rubicon in particular, Lindsay? You know, they've had tough times, and is this sort of improvement in their stock price over the 12 months the sign of those tough times being over, or a new strategy? You know, we know that once Michael Barrett became CEO, that was rowing back a couple of years now. We were expecting sort of to see different things from Rubicon, and I think probably his main sort of target at the time was just to turn the company around and then steady things. But we're actually now starting to see growth. Is that something to do with opportunities for SSPs, or you think it's the way that Rubicon have been managed and led?
I think it's down to almost kind of taking a step back from themselves and working out what they were good at and what they were bad at. For example, they missed the boat on header bidding in the early stages, and they were the last exchange to even kind of know it was a thing, and they didn't think it would be big. And then everyone else jumped on the bandwagon, and they were like, oh crap, well, we've missed the boat here quite drastically. How do we get out of this? So they obviously then launched things retrospectively, but in doing so, actually, in some cases, launched better products.
Yeah.
So they've actually kind of taken a step back, looked at where the successes and failures have been, and come in a bit later with a kind of a loyal subset of customers, of clients, and work with them to deliver something, you know, stronger and better. Michael Barrett was an interesting choice, an inspired choice, as Kieran has called him, the rainmaker of ad tech. Mm. He comes in, turns companies around, is able to kind of, you know, help them deliver growth, and he's doing that. But he came in at an interesting, a dire time when their stock price was like a cent or something. It was ridiculous. And he's turning things around, but it's taken time. I remember the first few earnings calls, things were looking even worse than when he joined, and everyone was going, oh, this is a bad move. Maybe Rubicon just can't be saved. Mm. And everyone's thinking this is the end for them. But he's kept at it, and the company's kept at it, and they've not tried to do anything ridiculously big and bold. They've just tried to kind of be a decent partner for publishers and also advertisers on the exchange side of the business as well.
Yeah.
Again,
additional kudos to him, right? Because from what I understand, talking to people that are there that I used to work with, they have, you know, listened internally to try and work out what that strategy should be. And they've talked to people who've recently joined the business and people who've been in the business for a long time to set out the strategy. And the strategy has worked. And this is kudos. This is proof of that. And the reality of the markets being so short-termist sends that downward spiral when somebody joins and they can't turn it around within a few weeks or a few months.
Yeah.
The trade desk are going to be in a really tough bind now, right? Because the market, and they're going to be noticed. They're on people's radar, is my point, right? Mm. So now the market analysts are going to start to work out, well, what more can this company do? Are they going to head to 2,000%, or should we be trying to sell? And who knows, right? Once you're on the radar, it becomes a slightly different proposition.
Mm. For sure. And I mean, you know, sort of globally, we're just facing, you know, pretty uncharted waters financially, economically, you know, at the moment. We don't really know what things are going to look like for global economies over the next 12 months from this particular position right now today. So, yeah, it looks like it's going to be a tough job ahead, but fascinating to watch, and great to see these ad tech companies continuing to, you know, to not just, well, in, you know, in the Trade Desk's case to thrive, and in Rubicon's case to survive and start to do better. It's really, Heartwarming.
Yeah.
Heartwarming, yes. Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on to the second part of the podcast. Julian, let's have a little bit of a chat about what you're up to at DigiCake. You're working on a couple of consultancy projects. What are you focusing on at the moment?
So at this moment in time, I've taken on some projects DigiCake because I left IPONWEB in April and I was looking for a new role and started to look at, you know, where there is gaps in the market. So some of this has been taking on projects for various sort of publishers, ad tech, talk to people about in-housing. And some of these conversations have been really, really exploratory, but some of them have, you know, been turned into projects. And I've got a fun one this afternoon, actually. I'm working with a stand-up comedian who's very, very keen to understand TikTok. And
amazing.
I know it's a bit of a niche one.
Do you know TikTok, Julian?
Do you understand TikTok?
Yeah,
Please tell me you use it.
I've been researching TikTok and discovered that there's a lot of comedy on there, and as somebody who's got a live audience and sold out their Edinburgh run, he's very keen to understand if he can get something out to that audience, because that audience, as I've already said about Gen Z, has a very different view on the world, a very different view on the internet and what it should be. And he thinks that if he can get some popularity there, he's going to be in a great position to sort of, you know, if he travels to somewhere and does a show on Saturday night, he could probably do a Saturday matinee for a younger audience, which is more money in the bank from live, right? I mean, it's really weird, some of the projects I've been talking to, but mostly it's, you know, it's publishers wanting to talk about increasing their revenue.
Monetization, it's
ad tech wanting to connect with more partners, find out what partners are missing so that they can make more money or spend more money more efficiently, and advertisers interested in in-housing and what this in-housing trend is and why it exists.
And it's amazing to me that, you know, I feel like we've been talking about in-housing for such a long time now. I feel like that world should be a little more accessible for advertisers, but I bet it's not. I bet there's still loads of advertisers out there that are like, what the hell am I supposed to be doing here?
Yeah.
How do I navigate my way around this? Who's talking sense? Do you find that?
Yeah, definitely. Mm. And there's a gap of information. Like we've already, you know, discussed in this episode about publishers not knowing about how real-time bidding works and why those cookies are on their page, right? To make personalized advertising work, to make bidders bid. The demand side has the same problem. And advertisers, you've just got that simple ratio, right? If there is one demand side platform, there could be 10 agencies using it, and there's probably like 70 advertisers working with those 10 agencies. So, you know, there's just more and more companies coming to the fore, hiring people for a specialism in our niche, listening to podcasts like this, which is absolutely fantastic. Welcome to the community. Mm. But many of them just really want to know what other competitors are doing and what's good practice and what's bad practice. And actually what's happening in the black boxes once they have set something up with in a demand side platform. What happens after that? Like, how does it get to the publisher page? Because they just don't know how that works. And obviously I've worked right in the tech in the middle, so I can sort of unpackage some of that for the advertiser side in-housing, or the publisher trying to understand why there might be a shortfall of revenue recently because Google have done a test on their site.
Excellent. And what about, you were also mentioning that you're doing some stuff in sports tech.
Yeah.
Talk about that a bit.
So, having the time in between roles, because I was out there sort of looking the job market, and then DigiCake is focusing on some projects until I find the next full-time role, which is what I'm actively looking for. The interesting thing has been the research that I've jumped into. So I jumped into some research looking at 5G and sports tech. So if you look at sports tech, there's conversations about sort of fan engagement. And one thing that sports companies are looking for, you know, whether it be clubs or sports organizations, federations and stuff, is to make more money. As you can see today in the news, there's been covered by about an English Football League club, Bury Football Club, went into liquidation because they just mismanaged all their money. This is a big, big thing. In England, the Premier League is booming, but the rest of the league is suffering and there's clubs going bankrupt. So there's two things going on. Clubs want to make more money, but they also want to improve fan engagement. So you're starting to see tests where people are using technology to like order food to their seat. Mm-hmm. And they are missing information that we would think of quite simply of, right, okay, so you've ordered it to your seat. That's obviously on my login data. You know me because I'm a season ticket holder. All of that kind of stuff is not coming together because they're only just starting to work with CRMs. So monetization in this area is not there. And it's taken me down a route of looking at sponsorship as well. So I'm really interested to hear from anybody who knows a lot more about sponsorship than I am, I'm discovering, because it's a fascinating area. And when 5G comes in, wow. I mean, it's going to be like up to 100 times faster in some cases. And we talked...
I can't wait for that day. I can remember 3G, but I still have some 4G moments where I'm like, why is this not faster? 5G is going to be amazing.
Yeah. I mean, listen to this, right? An HD movie that's 3 gigabit in size currently takes 27 minutes to download on a LTE, which is like your standard 4G connection. That will download in 35 seconds.
Well, I mean, just bring it
Holy
on.
Crap.
Yeah, now, bring it on.
A lot of things that I've read and people I've started to speak to in telecoms who've been talking to me about 5G have been talking about how it's going to solve, you know, when in like a sports stadium or in a music event, you're unable to get reception just because there's so many,
too many people.
It's going to solve for that problem. So once you've solved for that problem, you can start doing stuff with fans while they're in their seat. So
that's much more personalised and individual.
Much more personalised.
So just in those conversations, just helping me understand that a little bit more, you're having those conversations with sports club owners or promoters or...
I've just been fact-finding, yeah, really, right. And just discovering that there is, like us in ad tech or in martech, there is a whole sports tech scene out there, which is really, really varied. It varies from the things that you would probably think would be logical if I said sports technology, which would be like, hey, I'm playing golf and I've hit a bad shot. Where's my ball? Oh, well, I've put a chip in the ball so I can find my ball, right? I can locate it wherever it goes.
Yeah.
Right through to companies trying to do stuff specifically around fan engagement, like how can we help somebody order their halftime refreshments and bring it to their seat, and how can we help the club understand that this is something that they do habitually and therefore they can do it as quickly and as easily, as hassle-free as possible. You know, it's really quite wide variety, and therefore it's been really interesting to dip in and talk to people and about various parts of their businesses, whether they be established or starting up. It's been a real educational learning curve. And when you add it to 5G, I just we were talking earlier about the lack of 20 years ago, there wasn't a moment where people said, well, ads as a society, let's have ads fund free content. We didn't have that, and we're still dealing with the repercussions. If you think about the network latency dropping from 100 milliseconds at 4G to 10 milliseconds at worst, and you then start having all these Internet of Thing devices being powered, we're going to see a very, very different set of businesses come about, just the same way that Uber came about once apps were developed, right? So there's going to be this new wave. So I've been tapping in, trying to work out, is there something really big on the horizon that's going on? I will admit I haven't found it yet, but it's been really interesting to talk to people and learn more about these areas and try and think about, from ad tech and martech perspective, what have we learnt that can be transported into their world, and where can we as an industry, you know, possibly add some value to things which are about to happen or currently going on in a different sector.
For sure. I feel like we sort of have elements of that conversation when we're talking about out of home as well, actually. Digital out of home experience and how that can become a little more sophisticated and a little more personalised. Because I think you're right, you know, if we live in an environment which will be very soon, which will be upon us very soon, where we're connected that much more instantly to things, then imagine the possibilities for how you discover things, how you experience things, and how you connect with and converse with people that are providing you with goods and services, whatever those might
be. Exactly. And there's an assumption here with Internet of Things. If you talk to some people about some of the things that will come into your home, so today you might have a Google Home or an Alexa, but they're talking about, like, say, a smart fridge. So the idea being that if you run out of milk, if you're not lactose intolerant or, you know, just off milk for a while, you know, you open up the fridge and that space where the milk goes has been removed for a period of time longer than it takes to, you know, use that milk and put it back in the refrigerator. It will reorder milk. So the idea is, there's probably a monetization model in trying to connect that up so that the shopping you know, a margin is taken out somewhere in the purchase or the delivery of that item. But advertising is going to be in there somewhere.
For sure.
Like, clearly. Oh, definitely.
For sure.
Yeah,
for
we've
sure.
discussed this in the past as well with how can you, with what is currently available to you, which largely is just smart home speakers, how you can, obviously that don't allow advertising, how you can still make yourselves relevant. So there are actually agencies that have teams that work on helping companies with their organic listings. If someone's searching for something on Alexa, a product on Alexa, and sorry if all your smart speakers are going off right now, that you'll be able to get higher
Alexa.
Rankings and you'd be mentioned first.
Yeah.
Rather than 10th or whatever, just by doing classic kind of organic optimization.
Yeah.
So there's those kind of things happening. And what the next stage of that is, will you have advertising? Will you have connections with supermarkets that, or with, you know, FMCGs in general that mean that you, if you're an orange juice brand, you can start advertising different type brands of orange juice if the orange juice has run out or running out?
Yeah.
How will they know how long a bottle of orange juice normally lasts in your fridge? Mm. So if you've got a day of it left, you'll have different ads for orange juices on the screen on the front of your smart fridge. Something that I think Samsung's working on, which is just insane.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to be like this, but the reality is we've learned from 20, 25 years ago that there wasn't a societal discussion. So what will happen is very clearly two things that we've learned in our marketplace, which is if there is no laws in place to say that something is illegal, so going back to data privacy in browsers, if that had been stopped at source, then how we transact today wouldn't be possible. So therefore, companies will do things for monetary gain until such time as it is prohibited. The same thing applies here with this advertising. If there is a financial opportunity to be able to deliver something, then as a society, we haven't said, oh, I'm going to buy this smart fridge, but I agree that there's a monetization model to reorder my orange juice and my milk, but I don't want that advert on the screen. Then it's that advert's going to happen on the
yeah,
screen.
Yeah, it will.
Right? And it's
absolutely
not just
will.
That device. There's going to be so many other devices that are all going to, you know, talk to each other, whether it be in the house or even in the street. Like if Bristol has a funny scheme where they've got the lampposts are all talking to each other, like around the quayside.
What do they say?
They're all interconnected, so they're able to be able to communicate with each other, these lampposts, and be able to
when to turn on and turn off.
Turn on, turn off is the basic, but also to work out when to have cameras working as well as part of it, I believe.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and that's weird. Not a new thing. That's a 2-year-old study.
Yeah, because I imagine it would be sort of energy saving as well. So the idea is sometimes, there's no activity and no one around.
Think about it this way. That's a council, right? That's a local authority deciding that they want to try and use technology to improve things. And they're getting into a whole world of data privacy and stuff like that you would think a council would just jump right back from. But Bristol went and became innovative.
Interestingly,
right?
Typically, those public sector organisations have actually got much, much, much more comprehensive understanding of data privacy laws and data privacy restrictions, and they've got usually a much clearer interpretation of it, and they've generally got a team of people sitting behind them going, no, you can't do that. Yes, you can do that. No, you can't do that. So they're a little bit more set up for it, I would argue.
Yeah.
So what's more interesting is the innovation, the fact that they've been bold enough to go and do something like that, because it's probably expensive to invest in the first instance. And then, you know, what's the payoff in the long run? They'll have obviously worked that out.
Totally.
It's fascinating stuff.
And I'd love to hear from anybody who wants to talk more about, you know, if they know stuff about sponsorship and if they know, you know, but they want to talk more about this 5G thing, because I'm just finding it fascinating as I'm digging in more.
We did talk with
a
company, the sponsorship, sports sponsorship company a while ago. I can't remember.
InCrowd.
That's it. Yes.
InCrowd. We did.
Yeah. Aware of them.
You are. I figured you probably would be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an interesting space. And then one of the other things I've done at DigiCake is, you know, representing a US-based organization called Spaceback over here in Europe. They do a very interesting thing. They take social posts, provide a user interface so that a buyer, an advertiser, an agency can turn that into a display creative. So it's possible to take an Instagram post or a Twitter post, turn it into a 300x250 advert and run that. And obviously as a user looking at that, it's kind of more glossy and more interesting as a brand play than a display ad. So therefore it's getting a higher click-through rate. So it's a performance meets brand kind of offering. And no, you know, they've done really well in the States as an organization, great alumni of people who've been very successful at previous companies and made exits. So yeah, I had a chat with them. And they were very keen that I help them sort of educate the market about what they were doing. So
that's cool. You did some examples for us as well of some ExchangeWire social media posts, yeah. And they do look very good.
Yeah.
I did. And what was funny about that is obviously I noticed that your Facebook tails off at some point, which obviously listening to the podcast, I totally understand why that happened.
You can see why. It became a challenge to engage with our audience on that particular platform. Yeah. Put it that
You've
way.
You've got a big audience on there as well.
We do have a big audience, especially in Asia, actually.
Yeah.
But then every time it's we posted something platform. In Asia, we would get like 50 million likes, and a lot of them were from like 8-year-old boys
really?
That clearly had no interest in ad tech. So we realised, this isn't the best platform for us, maybe.
Our relationship with Facebook. Okay, I think we've run out of time. Thank you very much, Julian, for coming in and chatting with us this morning. That was very interesting.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Rachel, Lindsay. Thank you very much for having me.
Our pleasure. Thanks, Lindsay.
Thank
that
you.
That was this week's podcast.